This call is being recorded.
I want to thank everyone again for joining us. We'd like to be fairly brief with these remarks so we can turn it over to all of you and answer your questions. So I'm going to talk a bit at first and then hand things over to Natalie and Josh to share some more information. At a high level, Gibbel's research, in my opinion, is really in the best shape that it has ever been in. We have a larger team. The team has more experience and ability than it's ever had before, which means that our research is covering more ground more deeply. You know, if you look at this year's recommendations, I think what you'll see is they're higher quality than our recommendations have ever been in the past. And so all of this capacity allowed us to investigate more new programs and more new charities in 2017 than we ever have before in previous years. We also continued GiveWell's incubation program, which supports the development of future top charities. Most importantly, this year, we added two new top charities to our list. We also continued to recommend the seven organizations that had been top charities last year. I'm not planning to talk at length about the charities that we've recommended before, since they've been on our list a long time. We're very happy, though, to answer any questions that people have about them. Don't take silence as any sign of what we think of those charities. You know, I remain extremely excited about their work and supportive about the amazing work that they do. Well, we did add two new top charities to our list that I just want to highlight for people. One is Helen Keller International's Vitamin A Supplementation Program. The other is Evidence Action's No Lean Season Program. We're excited about both. Helen Keller's International Vitamin A Program, we found them and came to them from a long-standing interest in vitamin A supplementation. It's a program that delivers vitamin A pills to children under the age of 5 twice every year, and a series of randomized controlled trials show that delivering these pills significantly reduces child mortality. This program had been significantly funded by government donors previously, but some of that funding has gone away more recently. And when we found them and this funding need, we were, you know, very glad to be able to fill it and are really excited about the work that they're doing. No Lean Season is different. They were a GiveWell incubation grantee for a long time. We had been supporting Evidence Action's work on this program since 2014, have been supporting them as they've grown and conducted more research, been following along. And, you know, we now believe this year that the scale they've reached and the track record they've demonstrated is sufficient for them to qualify as a top charity. And, you know, I think one interesting thing to note about No Lean Season is it demonstrates that GiveWell's research and our methods can go beyond the straightforward health delivery, you know, commodity delivery health programs that so many of our recommendations have been in the past. So, you know, we're excited to, you know, generally expand the nature of the groups on our list, and I think No Lean Season is a good reflection of that. So now I'm going to turn things over to others, just briefly what they're going to talk about. I'm going to ask Josh to talk a bit about the research process that we use to identify new top charities. Natalie then is going to talk about some of the strengths and weaknesses of our top charities. Josh will also talk about our incubation program and some of the other research we're doing. And then I'd like to close with some important considerations for donors to keep in mind as they're thinking about, or as you're thinking about, where you'll donate this year. And after that, we'll open the floor up for questions.
Great. Thanks, Ellie. So just a basic overview of our research process. So in brief, we start our research process by reviewing the academic literature for different interventions, so programs that are implemented, you know, regardless of which charities implement them. So we start first at the general level of assessing the evidence base and cost effectiveness of the program before moving to specific charities. So, you know, some examples of programs are deworming, malaria nets, vitamin A supplementation. So first we determine whether there's strong evidence for those interventions and how cost-effective they are before reaching out to charities. And we also follow new journal articles and find new programs, but we're working our way through existing literature to assess which programs we should be looking at. So once we determine that a program has strong evidence and seems as cost-effective as our current top charities, we go looking for charities that implement that program. So this, for example, was the process that led us to recommend Helen Keller International's Vitamin A program, because we saw that there was a lot of evidence on vitamin A suggesting that it reduces mortality and that it was similarly cost-effective to our existing program. So we reached out to charities that worked on that and ended up recommending Helen Keller International. So we call this part of our process intervention prioritization, and it's really crucial for going from the large number of charities and programs that we could potentially evaluate to a much smaller list that we then look at in much more depth. So once we prioritize an intervention and reached out to charities, we try to understand the type of funding we could direct to them if they become a top charity. We ask them about how they would use those funds. And then if they choose to participate, we go back and forth with them asking questions about their programs and monitoring an evaluation, which ultimately leads to our decision of whether to name them a top charity, a standout charity, or not to recommend them. So that's our process in a nutshell, and we're really happy to answer any more questions about this that people have throughout the call.
Great. Thanks, Josh. So Natalie, maybe you could talk a bit now about the strengths and weaknesses of our top charities.
Great. So there is a table in our blog post where we announced our top charities for the year that summarizes this in more detail. I'll just quickly go over the main factors that we considered in thinking about the strengths and weaknesses of our top charities. So the first is, how cost effective does an organization appear relative to cash transfers? This is a major input into our decision making. It's far from decisive, though. Our models are subject to significant uncertainty, and so we use this as one factor among many. The charities we recommend range in cost effectiveness from GiveDirectly, which distributes cash transfers and which we use as the benchmark for cost effectiveness of our other top charities, to Deworm the World, which we estimate as being 12 times as cost effective as cash transfers on average. The next factor that we put weight on is, how much do we know about the organization? So some of the organizations that we recommend, we've recommended them for many years, and we visited them in the field multiple times. Others are newer to us, and we don't know as much about them as we do our longer-running recommendations. Another qualitative factor that we consider is the monitoring and that the organization produces and the likelihood of our detecting problems in the program. So all of our top charities have strong monitoring relative to most charitable organizations. This is an important criteria for us in making an organization a top charity, but we do see major differences across top charities. So while some have high quality comprehensive monitoring where we're confident they would find problems, and we have seen problems in the past that give us more confidence in those systems, others have somewhat inconsistent or non-comprehensive monitoring, so that we feel that that problems could occur without us knowing about them. The last piece that we've thought a lot about is ease of communication with each of our top charities, and being able to get all of our questions answered is important to us. And in there is variation across our top charities in our ability to easily answer our major questions. So those are the main factors that we've thought about in terms of the relative strengths and weaknesses of our top charities. And I'm happy to answer more questions about the specific organizations if that is of interest.
Great. And I just want to talk a little bit about our incubation program, and then shortly after that, we'll open up for questions. So GiveWell Incubation Grants is a relatively new part of our work we've been focused on for the last few years. And the major goal of it is to help new groups become top charities in the future. And so we do provide a variety of support to make that happen for research, monitoring, and then also just programmatic support so that new charities could potentially become top charities in the future. And a major partner on this work has been a group called ID Insight, and they've given us the capacity to answer research questions that we don't have the ability to answer on our own by doing research in the field, which could be randomized control trials or monitoring of charities. And then we've also made grants to groups like the Center for Pesticide Suicide Prevention, which is working on policy change, which is, you know, working far outside of the bounds of what GIVL has done in the past, and helping us expand the types of opportunities that we're able to look at. And, you know, finally, I just wanted to briefly mention some of the work that we've done this year, but we haven't written about yet, in case people are interested in hearing more. So just, you know, a few areas that we've looked at. One, we've done a review of international education programs. We've done a review of family planning programs. We're working on a randomized control trial of new incentives program to do conditional cash transfers for immunization. New incentives is one of our incubation grantees. We've done some work to identify a group doing cataract surgery that we may be able to recommend in the future. And then finally, we've done some work to better understand how beneficiaries value different outcomes. So a major piece of our cost effectiveness model is trying to compare the benefits of different programs run by our top charities. And so, you know, some of them improve health or avert infant deaths, and some of them increase incomes. And one area that we're interested in looking at is how the beneficiaries of our programs value those different outcomes relative to each other. So passing it back to Ellie to talk about some other considerations.
So I wanted to wrap up here with just laying out some of the what I see as the most crucial considerations for donors to have in mind as you're thinking about your year-end gifts. Before I do that, now's a good time to think about what questions you have for us and to send them in. So far, we have a couple of questions that have come in. You can do that either by emailing info@givewell.org or using the chat interface if you are calling into this conference call via your computer. Please do not hesitate to ask us questions, however basic they may seem, because our goal with this conversation is to try to answer the questions that are on your minds. That's really why we want to put this together. So let me briefly lay out three considerations that I think are important for donors. So the first one is the remaining room for more funding that each of our groups has once we've taken into account the grants that we expect good ventures to make. So what do I mean by that? Good Ventures is a large foundation that supports the work of our top charities, and we expect them to give $75 million to our recommendation at the end of the year. We wrote about this in our blog post announcement, which included the specific amounts that we recommend they give to each organization. And so the, you know, something that I think everyone should keep in mind is that, you know, in some cases, we're not actively pushing donors to give more to some of our top charities because we think that Good Ventures has given them a significant amount and that they're well positioned to do more good work. That said, in all cases, we believe that the organizations we recommend could utilize additional funding effectively, whether or not Good Ventures has given funding to them already. You know, want to make sure that people are keeping that in mind as they look at our list, and of course, happy to answer questions about it. A second key consideration is the type of impact that the charity is having. Some of the groups we recommend, like the Against Malaria Foundation, which supports bed net distributions, they improve the health of the people that are served. You know, they prevent cases of malaria, which avert child deaths. Other organizations, so a good example here is Nolene Season, that subsidizes seasonal migration for people in rural Bangladesh during the famine season. Well, you know, that program increases people's incomes. And this is whether a donor values improving the health of the people that you're trying to help or saving lives versus increasing incomes, you know, is very much a matter of, I think, subjective, personal, philosophical values. And so I think it's important for people to keep that in mind as you're thinking about where you'd like to give. And then finally, you know, I think the groups we recommend have a spectrum of certainty of having impact. So on one hand, I think a donation to GiveDirectly is very likely to have a significant impact. You are delivering a significant amount of funding directly into the hands of some of the poorest people in the world, and a large body of evidence shows that people use those funds effectively and improve their lives. All the way on the other end of the spectrum, you have an intervention like deworming, where you give school-age children a pill twice a year to clear parasitic infections. There is some evidence, and it's quite strong, the evidence that exists, that these worms can cause debilitating effects that, if prevented, if treated, can enable people to earn significantly more, work harder, have higher wages, and have higher consumption in adulthood. And so there's this possibility that you could have this extremely large effect. But while the evidence that exists that support this claim is rigorous randomized controlled trial evidence, there's also a small number of studies that support this effect and some conflicting evidence. And so deworming is a case where, it's much less certain whether or not a donation has this significant impact. And then, somewhere in the middle, I would say, are programs that, like seasonal malaria chemo prevention and the Against Malaria Foundation's providing malaria nets. I think in some ways they are riskier in terms of their ability to have impact than GiveDirectly, but they're far more certain than an intervention like deworming. So I think this spectrum of risk and certainty is one that I think it's worth donors knowing about and considering when making donations. So now we're going to turn things over to you all for questions.
Great. Hi, everyone. So thank you so much. We've received some questions via the info follow-up.org or using the chat interface on Uber Conference. So I'm going to start with a few questions that came in about GiveWell's new top charities. So Sanjay, I'm going to unmute your line first.
Hi. Hang on, sorry, I think I've just caused an echo problem over here. I'm just going to try and resolve that. Okay, I think that's better. Sorry about that. Two questions, if I may. So first of all, about Helen Keller International, really interesting to read about that. My admittedly cursory review of your work suggests that it's very focused on averting child death. And I was just wondering whether you had any view about any other benefits that might arise from that work apart from that, maybe improving the quality of people's lives, for example. And a second question, if I may, about No Lean Season. There's just an interesting contrast there. When I've read other of your analysis about microfinance, it's been less positive. So it's interesting to see that you're willing to recommend No Lean Season. I was wondering if you could expand on that tension there. Thank you.
Thanks for the question. So on Helen Keller International, our cost effectiveness analysis, as you pointed out, only incorporates the benefits of averting child death, and our other top charities. We've often incorporated several different types of impacts, such as for the malaria-focused organizations, developmental impacts, and potential for bed nets, the potential impact on adult lives. For HKI, I think the benefits that we may be missing in our cost-effectiveness analysis are largely around child morbidity, so conditions that cause health problems without causing death. And so we have not dug into this evidence, but my impression is that there are some effects on, particularly in areas with severe vitamin A deficiency, there can be childhood blindness caused by vitamin A deficiency, as well as some other mild to severe conditions. We have not focused on that because we believe that the child death part is probably the most significant. But also there's the, it's the case that the areas that are, that the program operates in now have less severe vitamin A deficiency than in the past. And so I think we see, we expect to see less morbidity than we have in trials conducted in earlier decades.
Yeah, and then to your question about Nolene Season and the potential tension with our views on microfinance. So Nolene Season's program, I think, is quite different than most microfinance programs in that they're providing a no-interest loan that's specifically conditional on someone migrating to the city during the time when there isn't much agricultural labor in rural areas. So they're giving, you know, these loans for a very particular purpose, which we've seen from multiple randomized control trials leads to increased consumption for families during the lean season from two randomized control trials in particular. Whereas microfinance is more typically offering, you know, loans for a variety of purposes where you typically have to pay interest. So I think it's the targeted nature of this program and the strong evidence behind it that distinguishes it from microfinance.
All right, so the next question I'm going to read aloud came in via info, and it's from John. And the question is, you said earlier that Deworm the World was approximately 12 times as cost-effective as GiveDirectly. What unit are you using here? Is this Qualys? As someone relatively new to the mathematics of the effective altruism movement, could you please walk me through this example as a way to explain how you calculate cost effectiveness? They are both designated as top charities, so is the thesis that GiveDirectly has enough of an advantage in transparency reporting other categories to warrant a similar classification?
It's a good question. Let me start by answering the second part, which is, you know, why is GiveDirectly a top charity? So, you know, we in many ways see GiveDirectly as the, you know, the benchmark against which all other charitable organizations that we're considering is measured. And, you know, so we believe that they deserve that designation with that in mind. In the event that we did not find other opportunities that clearly surpassed GiveDirectly in, sort of overall expectation of impact, we would be very happy seeing a lot of money go to GiveDirectly because I think they effectively do a significant amount of good. But in many ways, that's a decision that we've made here to put, you know, GiveDirectly as the, the floor of, you know, getting onto our top charity list. Like, that is the bar that organizations have to clear. I should say specifically that they do have, you know, I think GiveDirectly is outstanding on all dimensions that relate to them as an organization. You know, their transparency, their reporting, the ways in which they've experimented and do research on their programs, including some of the work that they're doing now, looking into new programs and influencing other actors. And so I think across the board, they're certainly an organization we recommend, very strongly, we think very, very highly of. The second part of your question is how do we actually think through this question of 12 times as cost effective? And so in this case, what we're doing is we're saying, when you give to GiveDirectly, you give a person the ability to consume more immediately because they've received additional cash. They also have the opportunity to invest that money, and they can then have the ability to spend more in future years. At the same time, so in essence, a donation to GiveDirectly creates this series of cash flows that the recipients can utilize for consumption. And then we see a similar potential impact as what the deworming organizations cause. In our view, they treat children for parasitic infections, and then when those children reach adulthood, the evidence that we're relying on indicates that they may have higher wages than they otherwise would have. And so we, you know, directly compare the cost of donating to GiveDirectly and then that series of cash flows against the cost of donating to the deworming charities, you know, the likelihood that it has the impact that we expect or that, you know, we hope for, and then just, you know, compare those increase the cost to increase consumption by that amount directly between the two organizations. And our model shows that Deworm the World is 12 times as cost effective as GiveDirectly. I know we say this a lot, but it's important to put the caveat that, you know, this is, you know, just a spreadsheet model. And I think in what it means to me is that, you know, I believe that there likely are significant differences in cost effectiveness between Deworm the World and GiveDirectly. But the model is subject to, you know, uncertainty in inputs, you know, uncertainty in decisions about how to model. And, you know, I don't think it's true that we should literally believe that Deworm the World is 12 times as cost effective as GiveDirectly. You know, to give the, you know, an example, if Deworm the World were to, you know, just not spend 11/12 of the funds that it received, I wouldn't see it as, you know, an equivalently good investment or equivalently good donation option to GiveDirectly. You know, instead we use the cost effectiveness as an indicative factor of, you know, how much more impact per dollar the organization could be having, and then we incorporate that with the other considerations that we've talked about earlier.
So the next question also came in from the info emails, and it's from Kate. And the question is, can you talk to your research in education versus health? Is there a range of impact, and to what degree are health charity programs greater than education programs?
Yeah, so it's a really good question. I think that the biggest difference that we see today between health programs and education programs, and here I'll talk specifically, you know, I'm focusing on education programs that serve the developing world, so the poorest parts of the world, is the amount and level of evidence indicating impacts on life outcomes. So let me explain what I mean by that. You know, I think a question that I have about education programs is, you know, let's say you run an education program that increases attendance in, you know, the early years of schooling. Or let's say you run a program that increases standardized test scores throughout schooling. The question I have is, you know, what does that mean for the impact that that program has on someone's life? You know, how do we, what can we say about the magnitude of the effect that it has? You know, on one hand, I think there's a reasonable starting point which says, people with improved education will be better positioned to be successful in their adult lives. You know, I think the, you know, an alternative perspective would say, you know, we really don't know what we're getting when we increase attendance or increase test scores in a developing country. You know, the complicated labor market, different, you know, than what we have here. And so we feel like this is a question that we want to try to answer with empirical evidence. Until recently, there were very few studies that had, you know, and I should say randomized controlled trials that had explicitly followed up on education programs to see what types of impacts they had on people's lives as adults. In the last few years, some of these studies have come out. So there are studies now that, you know, provide vouchers to attend private school in developing countries or provide scholarships to attend secondary school where it might not otherwise be accessible, and then measure people's, you know, incomes, also, you know, in adulthood. They also will measure other indicators like women's age at first marriage or age at first child. And so, you know, right now, the amount of evidence that exists that is, in our opinion, very high quality and reliable is, you know, much more limited relative to health. And so health is very different. You know, in health, you know, when there's a large body of evidence that shows that distributing seasonal malaria chemo prevention, running that program prevents cases of malaria, and that malaria cases cause death. That, you know, distributing insecticide-treated nets to prevent malaria works, and that, you know, that prevents child deaths. And so the amount of evidence that exists in health is larger. And the other important consideration between health and education is how generalizable the evidence is from one context to another. And so in health, the mechanism through which the program works is biological. You know, you prevent the mosquito from infecting an individual with malaria, they don't get malaria, and then they, you know, won't get sick and can't die. On the flip side, in education, I think the evidence that we have from, say, Ghana and Colombia is not as easily extended to some other context, you know, another country, say. And so that's an additional challenge with education programs that, you know, we plan to engage with as our focus on education, you know, as we continue on with that research in future years.
All right, the next few questions are dealing with some of GiveWell's future plans. So I'm going to read a question from Mark that came in through the info email. The question is, despite the fact that charity dollars have more impact in poor countries and that the needs are great there, some donors want to allocate some of their giving to poor people in the United States. Does GiveWell have any plans to seek out effective charities that serve the U.S. poor?
Yeah, so it's a good question. I think that, I think GiveWell's focus is going to remain looking for the opportunities that best meet our criteria. So have the strongest evidence of effectiveness and the strongest cost effectiveness. When GiveWell started, we didn't just settle in on international aid. In our first few years, we looked at U.S. programs as well as international programs. And the reason we settled on international aid is that we felt that the programs there best met our criteria. But this is a question that we have not recently revisited. And, we do intend at some point in the next few years to explicitly revisit the question of comparing the cost effectiveness of charitable programs in richer countries and the evidence behind them to the programs that we're currently recommending. I suspect that we're going to continue to focus on international aid, but it's certainly very possible that in the, 10 years that, since GiveWell started, the evidence has changed, the world has changed, and that's a question we'd like to explicitly consider. I certainly hope that, and I think it would be great if a resource existed for donors who wanted to serve the U.S., and I think what I can imagine happening is something similar to what Animal Charity Evaluators has done for animal welfare-oriented groups, where they've really, I think, taken a lot from the GiveWell process and methodology and then applied it to a cause area that we were not focused on. And, I would just be thrilled to see a group start with a focus on U.S. organizations, but building off of GiveWell's general methodology and process.
Great. So the next question also came in through info, and it's from Juan. Could you discuss your outreach strategy? Is it a priority? How much resources are you spending to try to grow your donor base? So I'm going to speak to this a bit since I focus on outreach at GiveWell. Yes, outreach is now a major organizational priority for us. For some context, GiveWell is 10 years old this year, and historically we have focused very little on proactive outreach about our work, so trying to get GiveWell in front of people who've never heard of it before, growing our donor base. We've been very fortunate to have connected with our donors through media coverage and sort of organic connections, but we're now at a point where we are identifying more funding opportunities than we expect to fill with our current donor base. And so we are very actively prioritizing work on outreach in order to try to significantly increase the amount of money that GiveWell is directing to our recommended charities. And so what that's meant so far is that we are kind of in experimentation mode where we're trying new things to try to determine which will be the most successful for GiveWell at doing that. One example, if you listen to podcasts, you might have heard ads for GiveWell either earlier this year or now during giving season. That was one thing that we tried out in February and had some initial success. such that we thought that we should replicate it during giving season. So that's one area in which we're kind of experimenting with outreach. You know, we're thinking about our outreach kind of in a few different buckets, you know, fundraising type work, marketing type work, and media outreach, since many of our donors have found GiveWell through media coverage. And so, you know, we're working on strategies in each of those areas and trying to develop a better sense of how GiveWell can grow its donor base and move more money to the charities that we think are really excellent going forward. And maybe Ellie can speak a little bit to the resources, I think, piece of the question.
Sure. Simply put, you know, outreach has not been a major priority of ours historically, though we've been extremely fortunate for the donors who found us and used our research. And now we see it as a major organizational priority. You know, roughly speaking, GiveWell is made up of, you know, three broad areas: research, business operations, and outreach. And I think it's reasonable to assume that over time, outreach will, you know, move from being about one dedicated staff person and a very small budget to about a third of what we do. And so that's the general direction that we're heading. We currently feel like we have the right level of operating funding to be in a position to experiment with the types of outreach activities that we think could be most effective. So we're hoping to put some degree of resources into it, experiment, learn, and then, you know, decide what to do next. Wanted to just add a note that in terms of our cost effectiveness estimates, for those who don't know, and Sanjay, thanks for this suggestion, the full Google spreadsheet model is available on our website. If you just Google GiveWell cost effectiveness models, you'll find it. And, you know, that goes for basically everything we're talking about here. You know, our goal is to put all of the detail, the references, the background information behind what we believe on our website. And so if there's anything that you want to check or get more information about afterwards, you should be able to find it there. If you have any trouble finding it there, please don't hesitate to email us. We're happy to help you find it. We know there's a lot there. And of course, also happy to answer, you know, questions directly. I think there aren't many other questions that we see right now. So if you have more questions, you know, please send them in via info@givewell.org or put them in the Uber conference chat. You know, we're very happy to answer what you have. I wanted to quickly ask a couple questions that I think are you know, might be of interest to folks, and I'll ask Josh to answer these. So, you know, I guess, Josh, what are the research projects that GiveWell is going to do in 2017 that you are most excited about?
Sure. So some of the research projects I'm most excited about for 2017, I think a lot of them have to do with looking into new domains that GiveWell hasn't done a lot of research on in the past. So one major change at GiveWell that we talked about in our blog post at the end of this year is that there's now a large amount of room for more funding that isn't being filled at our current top charities. And so I think that makes it slightly more valuable to look for opportunities that are potentially substantially more cost-effective than our existing top charities. And one major area that we're planning to investigate that has the potential for greater cost-effectiveness is policy interventions. So we're looking at a variety of programs that aim to influence government policy in order to improve people's lives. So a few examples are tobacco taxation policy, which would, you know, reduce tobacco consumption and avert death. Another one is reducing exposure to lead poisoning in the developing world. And another one is looking at interventions to improve road safety in developing countries, where oftentimes traffic deaths are a much bigger cause of death than in many developed countries. So I think all of those programs, because there's the potential to influence a large amount of government funding with a relatively small amount of donor funding, have the potential to be extremely cost-effective. So I'm very interested to see what we'll find there. And just to give examples of a few other domains that I'm excited to take a look at and share our research on, you know, I think our work on looking at potential cataracts-related interventions and better understanding whether there are opportunities related to surgical interventions that are very cost effective is one piece of our work I'm excited about. We're also planning to look into other domains such as agricultural interventions to see whether there are opportunities to improve incomes via those programs. And then, you know, I'm excited to publish some existing work that we've done on family planning, education, and also nutrition. We've done some work to look at the effects of early life growth on long-term outcomes such as income and adulthood. So those are a number of areas where, you know, Gibble has done some new research that I'm excited to share.
Cool. So I've one more question for you, Josh. And you know, right now we don't have any other questions. If you've been holding out on sharing a question, now's the time to share it. Because otherwise, after I guess the next question, we'll call it. So yeah, if you'd like to submit questions, you can do that again via the Uber conference chat or info@gibble.org. Just send an email off. I mentioned, or maybe Josh mentioned earlier, a group called ID Insight. They're a group that we're really excited about because for a long time, GiveWell just evaluated organizations and interventions on the basis of what information they already had or on the basis of the research that already existed. And ID Insight provides us this amazing opportunity. They're a research group that employs economists and other analysts, and you know, they are able to go out and conduct field research themselves to assess whether or not a program is having an impact. They can help an organization build out its monitoring and evaluation system. So if there was a group that GiveWell was excited about and wanted to recommend but didn't have good monitoring in place in the past, we just wouldn't recommend them. There was nothing we could do. But ID Insight is a partner that gives us this opportunity to create the sort of monitoring and evaluation that we would need to see so that we could, you know, we could potentially support them. So this is a big change at GiveWell. It's a group that we're excited about and a partnership that I think could yield a lot of benefits. And so the question that I have that I think is worth addressing is, you know, what are the projects that we're considering working with ID Insight on, you know, and which are the ones that seem most promising?
Sure. So to give some examples of several projects, you know, one that I mentioned earlier is surveying beneficiaries of our charities on how much they value different outcomes. So I think this has been a major uncertainty and is a significant decision that we make every year when we're deciding how to allocate funds is, you know, how do you value improving health versus improving income? And I'm excited that, you know, an issue in the past has been that we haven't been able to get much information from other actors about how they value these outcomes. And so I'm glad that we're going to be able to try to survey some of the beneficiaries of these programs to see how they would make those kinds of trade-offs. Another example is that ID Insight is running a randomized control trial of new incentives program on conditional cash transfers for immunization. So New Incentives is one of our incubation grantees. They're attempting a program in Nigeria where they give conditional cash transfers if a child receives immunization. And I think that ID Insight's trial of this program is going to be very helpful for us understanding how cost-effective that program is and how strong the evidence is for that program. Another example of work that we haven't made much progress on yet, but that we may do in the future, and it is an example of the kind of thing that ID Insight can provide, is that we looked into the evidence for family planning programs and saw that there wasn't much rigorous evidence of strategies for increasing uptake of contraceptives. So basically, evidence that we could apply to charities programs to understand how cost-effective they are. And I think in the past, we may have just been stuck with what existed, but with ID Insight now, we could potentially explore the possibility of running randomized control trials with those groups. And finally, I wanted to mention, you know, some work on understanding the actual coverage, the potential biases in coverage surveys that our charities run. So a question that has continued to come up for us is how much or how reliable self-report is for determining the actual reach of programs. So, for example, our deworming charities will ask parents or children whether they've received deworming pills after a deworming program has been run. This has been the best evidence that we could rely on to understand how much people are being reached by these programs. But it would be useful for understanding the potential differences in coverage between charities if we had some examples where we spot-checked and did very rigorous analysis of how reliable that recall was. And so that's another type of field research that IDInsight may be able to help us with.
Great. And we received another question from Steve, which is, can you tell us how many people work at GiveWell and how much time you guys are putting into creating your top charities list? I'm interested to know how much people time is invested.
Great. So GiveWell has 20 total full-time employees, 9 of whom work full-time on research, and several contractors who also spend significant amounts of time on this work. And so some of that research time each year goes to creating the top charity list for that year, and some of it goes to research that will benefit our top charity list for future years. I would say maybe about half of the 9 full-time researchers are working on direct work that's directly benefiting the current year, and the rest of the work is more looking towards the future and working on incubation grants and intervention research that won't immediately result in top charities.
And we have another question from Meredith, which is, which of your top child-saving charities has the highest certainty of effectiveness and why?
Sure. So I'll speak to the kind of independent evidence base for the different charities that are averting child death. So the primary top charities that we recommend where their major outcome is averting child death are the Against Malaria Foundation, which distributes bed nets, Malaria Consortium, which does seasonal malaria chemo prevention, and Helen Keller International, which is vitamin A supplementation. And I would say the highest certainty of effectiveness is probably pretty comparable between the Against Malaria Foundation and Malaria Consortium. And the major reason for that is that there are a large number of randomized control trials showing that bed nets work, and a large number of randomized control trials showing that seasonal malaria chemo prevention reduces malaria cases. And so we have a very high degree of confidence that these charities are averting child deaths. I'd say the major advantage that those charities have relative to Helen Keller International in terms of certainty of effectiveness is that the randomized control trials done on vitamin A supplementation were done 20 to 30 years ago when vitamin A deficiency may have been substantially higher. And we think that, you know, vitamin A deficiency is potentially the major mechanism by which, reducing vitamin A deficiency is potentially the major mechanism by which vitamin A supplementation averts child deaths. There's just relatively limited data about how much of a problem vitamin A deficiency is in the current context where Helen Keller International operates. But nevertheless, you know, our best guess is that it's quite a cost-effective program based on, you know, the weaker evidence about vitamin A deficiency that we have. But I think we have much greater confidence that, you know, malaria, for example, is still a major health burden, and that NETS and SMC reduce that burden.
Great. And there's a follow-up to that question, which is, should we be concerned about why government funding of HKI was removed?
Sure. So the HKI was primarily funded through the Canadian government and in the past, and they received several large grants for that work. The Canadian government is continuing to support vitamin A supplementation. However, due to decisions about how their grantees, they've decided to largely support UNICEF and their work, which previously they were funding both HKI and UNICEF and decided to shift to UNICEF only. They also are now targeting a different set of countries, which has left a funding gap for certain countries that HKI is looking to fill in the next few years. I think this is fairly common in that there are remaining gaps, funding gaps for highly effective interventions, and that it's not always a well-oiled machine of providing funding to the areas that need it most. This was definitely a major question of ours going into this investigation, and we spoke to several people on this topic and became convinced that this was a real gap, that the government funding was not going to be able to fill this, was not likely to fill this in the future, and that the reasons for not funding, that for HKI not receiving a renewal of that funding was not related to HKI's performance on the previous grant as far as we know.
We don't seem to have any other pending questions for the call, so I think we're going to wrap up here. Thank you very, very much for joining us today. We really appreciate it. As a reminder, the call was recorded, and we're planning to share the audio and potentially a transcript on our website. If you asked a question and you have concerns about that, please just let us know in the next 24 hours by emailing info@givewell.org. And we just really appreciate you taking interest in our work. So thank you so much.
Thank you very much.
Thanks.
Thanks.